Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello, welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we're speaking with Ben Davies, experienced money manager and CEO of Hind Capital, a fund primarily focused on the precious metals and commodity sectors. Given his vantage point from Europe, I've invited Ben on the program to speak with him about Europe's worsening debt crisis, the recent efforts to bail out Greece, of course, and what it all means for the world economy and for individual investors. We'll also address his outlook for gold and silver, of course. Ben, it's a pleasure to have you as our guest today.
Hey, Chris. I'm very flattered to be invited on, and I'm looking forward to a bit of a to and fro. That'd be great.
I am as well. We've had a very interesting pre-conversation here. I'm hoping we can surface some of that. But here we are with the recent developments in Greece, and I've just been absolutely astonished at what I've seen going on there with the ECB is now crowing about they're going to make a substantial profit on the bonds that they had purchased at a steep discount in the open market, and those bonds magically are going to be repaid in full because, of course, the ECB spared itself from taking any losses on those bonds and pushing those losses off onto private investors. This is just a very interesting dynamic that's going on. What are you seeing from your vantage point? How is this playing in your corner of Europe, and what is your view of what where we're going to go with all this?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting segue you introduced there. I mean, I think it's fair to say that state intervention is the key word here, and that concepts of self-determination and the rights of the individual are being thrown out the window. Clearly, the interesting dynamic of the ECB is that all bondholders and all equity holders in many respects should be have equitability, or they should have equity, so to speak. Equality, sorry, that's the word I'm looking for. And clearly in this case, they have given themselves seniority. The private sector is subordinate, and quite frankly, it's disgraceful. Clearly there is a political expediency going on here. They do not want to denigrate their balance sheet. They, bizarrely, in trying to keep the credibility of the ECB balance sheet, which has been ballooning monstrously, it now stands at some almost 30-35% of the GDP of Europe, and that is an exponential growth, something that you talk about extensively in your book and something we focus on as well. And I would go so far as to say that this exponential growth in the balance sheet is actually going to a rate of exponential of the exponential. And that sounds like a mouthful, but that gets very frightening because it becomes unsustainable. And politicians and the ECB, they totally understand that in the case of Europe. But if we just sort of circle back to specifics, actually the ECB, they bought a lot of these bonds at around 80% to par. So I think they bought around 50 billion. So the value they paid was, call it 40 billion. Now, they have, as you say, they've started to, I wouldn't say they're crowing about it, but what's happened is, because a lot of these bonds are short-term maturity, they actually, you get a pull to par. So as you come into the maturity period, which is March 20th, when there's a redemption and roller of the two-year bond, actually you're getting that pull to par. So in many respects, with the interest payment that they've received on it, they've made this and amortized this return. Now, they have foregone that in their as they want to try and help Greece reduce their debt to GDP to 120% by 2020, but they've done it at the expense of the, as you say, the private sector bondholders, which obviously is it rips up the legal framework by which we really exist within financial markets and within the rule of law, and this is really going to be an ongoing process, and a word I would really use to is financial repression to refer to this. At the end of the day, capital is scarce. So governments who need to keep funding themselves in order to keep the welfare state going need to find capital, and they will move at nothing to achieve that. And in this case, they've written up the rule book.
Let's extrapolate then if this situation, if I'm now a holder of Portuguese bonds, say, or Italian bonds, I'm looking at this rule change that's happened in the context of the Greek bonds. Potentially it's specific to the situation in Greece, but if I'm a private holder of Portuguese bonds now, I'm wondering if the same rule change won't be coming down the pike. I'm going to be slightly less willing to hold these bonds, meaning I'm going to want to sell them. I'm going to expect the price to go up. Would you expect this action where the collective action clause has been unilaterally and retroactively applied by the ECB to the Greek situation, doesn't that extend to potentially to other bonds? Will this not just make, are they not solving the problem in Greece? I'm putting air quotes up, solving the problem in Greece with this rule change. Are they not just then transferring a larger problem to much larger bond markets?
Very good question. Not an easy answer. I'm going to try and best efforts, but I would say it's very specific to each country, and it's very specific to what positions are in the marketplace, not only by investors but banks. In the case of Greece, so let's use that as an example, a lot of people have been under the misinterpretation that ISDA has not wanted a credit event to take place here. That is not the case. The market has been pricing in on these two-year Greek bonds, which are maturing March 20th. They've been pricing in with the package, which is your longer two-year bond, Greek bond, and your long some credit default swap on Greece. That package is known as a basis, and the probability assigned of a credit event is 93%. Now, that's an interesting dynamic because clearly people get paid out. The private sector have been holding out in the voluntary debt restructuring, because they actually want the credit event to take place. They want to get paid out on the credit default swap, and clearly they make more money in that situation. And the market's pricing that. And also I would say about ISDA, since I bring it up, is that ISDA, there's five banks effectively in charge, a committee in charge of the credit default swap market and the derivatives market. They do not want to ruin that market, the CDS market, and the derivatives market is a big market. It's a big earner for the banks. And it's what's part of keeping this whole casino credit going. So there's no way they want to endanger that. So I think people have been talking about ISDA not wanting a credit event on this occasion are barking up the wrong tree. So I sort of digress slightly, but I think it's pertinent to this because it then comes down to what are the positions at any time for participants in the private sector. Actually, it kind of flies slightly in the face of what I was saying about the ECB in terms of the hedge funds. They've not lost out on this at all. They've positioned themselves smartly. But certainly, I think it's very unfair on the Greek banks that they have to have experienced such a debt restructuring. They get a haircut when the ECB doesn't. And certainly that applies to any other banks that also had Greek bonds. But to be fair, this has been going on for a long time and positions have been pared down over that time. So in some ways, I hope I'm answering your question. I think it's very specific to each country and who the holders are, whether it be the private sector or the public sector. Clearly, a lot of peripheral debt has been held with the public sector, i.e. the private sector, banking sector, and it's been paramount for the ECB to make sure that system doesn't implode. And so they introduced the LTRO for 3 years as a mechanism by which they could effectively keep these banks afloat, and so they'd allow them to fund themselves on an ongoing basis. Now, we've had one LTRO, which is about $500 billion. We're going to have another one, which I suspect will be bigger, because I think that with all the downgrades we've seen recently, we're going to see actually more collateral has to be put up by the bank. So I think there might be people will take this free money pretty, with all the hands they can get on it. They'll grab it and put it onto their balance sheet. And it was a very clever piece of work by the ECB because ultimately it stabilized the system just in the medium term, because now they have inordinate amounts of liquidity, and as I say, it's for a three-year period, but unfortunately it just kicks the can down the road. What happens in 3 years' time? Does the ECB have to roll over, give back all the toxic assets it's taken on in return for cash? So all that's doing is is papering over the cracks in the short term. I hope that answers your question.
It does. So I'm interested in this kicking the can down the road phenomenon, because as I look at it very specifically again, what the IMF is projecting for Greece and how it gets down to 120% debt to GDP by, I think, 2020 or somewhere around there, they have them returning back to reasonable nominal 2-2.5% growth starting next year and carrying forward. What happens to all of these debt rescue plans if it turns out that the signals that I'm reading in the world right now say recession is, again, stalking the global landscape? It's certainly visiting Japan. It's visiting parts of Europe at this point in time. What if? How does recession and the debt rescue plans, how do those two come together?
As I think we're both agreeing here, they're trying to buy time. I mean, I think I need to sort of step back here and paint a bigger picture, which is that the fact is that we're going to have a cataclysmic end to this. The mathematics doesn't add up. You've talked about exponential debt trends just as we have. And it, at this point, if the policy prescription is more of the same, you will see that from 2007 that actually we have not delevered at all. Actually, the total credit has increased as a percentage of global GDP. Part of that is the common denominator has gone down a little bit, either GDP's fallen, but actually total credit has expanded quite dramatically.
You're going exactly where I was hoping we were going to go with this, which is we started by looking at Greece, and there's some nice specifics there, and we can talk about what's happening in the credit market specifically and specific policy tweaks that are being done or whatever the ECB is doing with the collective action clause. This is a useful in microcosm, Greece is a useful way to get at this larger issue, which is what I'm really interested in, which is that if we look at Greece and we try and pencil it out, it just doesn't add up. Mathematically, there's a problem in Greece. And the problem really centers on the idea that Greece, like much of the developed world, the United States, Japan, OECD in general, has been growing its debts far faster than it's been growing its income. And we've been enabled in this, I think, with the abandonment of the gold standard in 1971, and there's been really no tether. Just it was sort of convention, I guess, in an agreement as to how much we were going to allow ourselves to grow our debts. Well, eventually that pops, right? A credit bubble always finds a pin at some point in time. Potentially that was in 2008 with rising oil prices. It doesn't matter. Somehow it found its pin and started to collapse. And so here we are today and looking at Greece. And for me as an outside observer, I can't make the math work. Somebody's going to have to take extraordinary haircuts and losses on that. And again, Greece, just a microcosm for what I think is a larger systemic problem, which is that we're going to have to take some pretty extraordinary losses across the whole system. Against that, all of our fiscal and monetary authorities doing everything they can, apparently, to just paper it over, patch it up, keep the system going, status quo sorts of solutions. But from your perspective, I know you've written about this to some extent, that really we have to, you know, get right into the center of this and look at money itself, the fiat money system, the process of credit creation, the degree to which we, in essence, are fooling ourselves by borrowing from the future on a constant and increasing rates. Are we not at heart talking about the idea that we have a systemic problem that needs to be addressed, that's really going to be immune to whatever sort of minor policy tweaks can be envisioned, which is really, that to me is the story of Greece. It's an attempt in small ways and with whatever agreements and sorts of complexities can be dreamed up. It's really still avoiding the larger issue, which has to do with our money system itself.
Wow. You answered the question for me, I think. But yes, I think it is systemic. I think the monetary regime that exists today, which is, let's face it, has been around for 40 years. It's a fiat paper currency system, which means that it's by decree of government. And when we say paper, that it has no backing to any real assets such as gold or silver. So it is. And when we say by decree of government, we mean that you have to pay your taxes. So it's mm-hmm. de jure money. I think that really, when you talk about Greece and we get lost in the minutiae about CACs and collective action clauses, et cetera, et cetera. But really, we need to go to the bigger picture and perhaps get seemingly existential for some people, but actually we have to understand what money is. And money is created through the debt system. It is created out of thin air. A central bank or the Federal Reserve Bank, for example, creates money on the liability side of the balance sheet by buying treasuries, existing treasuries, off the U.S. Treasury itself onto the asset side, and as an accounting procedure, it puts down some paper money on the liability side against it. That is how you create money. Now, money creation is one methodology. How does that get into the system? Through something called fractional reserve banking. Every pound we hold on deposit is lent out multiple times. Maybe the base is 10 times. Now, this is a very insidious situation, really, that unfortunately human beings cannot be trusted to keep it at appropriate levels of lending or borrowing. And why is this? Well, if it goes all the way up to government, whereby effectively a democracy starts off with all the right intentions, but if it's predicated on a fiat currency system, eventually, in order to get re-elected, welfare will be paid for, wars will be paid for, your other Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid as you have in the US, healthcare will all be provided for. And they will buy their way into election. So obviously, each year the debt just keeps getting up and up and up and up. And obviously, there's a servicing to that debt. But eventually, the math doesn't add up. And you know, the doubling rates that you've talked about in your book is exactly what goes on here. At some point, we actually create so much debt that we're not able to service them. And today, although we talk about Greece at this particular point, the reality is we've actually hit a debt saturation for the entire world. Now, we've had other situations where, let's say, Argentina or Russia have had similar situations, perhaps even far worse, but they've been in isolation, so there hasn't been a systemic fallout. But this time, we actually, I believe, we have got to a situation where, rather like if you take Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe is a microcosm of the world. We actually had hyperstagflation there. We had debt deflation, as we're seeing now, and in order to really try and offset that, they primed the printing presses. I mean, they physically printed paper. The only difference today in the US, the UK, Japan is that they do something called quantitative easing, which is a euphemism for printing money electronically. And they're quantitative there and qualitative. They're expanding the balance sheet of the central bank. And also, in this case, I would argue they're denigrating the quality of the balance sheet because they're actually taking a lot of assets at par that aren't worth par. So this is the difference today, is that it's a global phenomenon. So in which case, we actually have a situation where capital is scarce. So every nation is trying to get capital. So this is going to lead to a lot of friction, not only domestically, but internationally. You can see that not only is the private sector being crowded out, but actually sovereign to sovereign is getting crowded out. And herein lies the problem, and herein is why each central bank is having to step in. Why is the UK printing inordinate amounts of money? Why is the European Central Bank printing inordinate amounts of money? Why is now Japan started again printing so much money? And actually, I mentioned Japan, that's an interesting, they printed quantitative easing after their credit induced bubble that collapsed in 1989-1990, and they've been in the mire for over 20 years now. And everyone said, oh well, we never saw inflation in that country. Well, guess what, because that was in isolation at that time. The rest of the world was doing just fine, thank you very much. This was a very specific credit induced bubble. Problem there is they exported inflation to the rest of the world. Now we have a situation where every country is effectively going down the same route as Japan, and most are following the similar policy prescription, as you can see. Well, Japan is a 30 trillion sized economy, and they definitely have hit the tipping point. They are 20 years down the line, so they are the one to watch, where they cannot service their debt anymore. And if you notice, the Bank of Japan is just back in announcing that they're going to have to ramp up the size of their balance sheet. They're buying JGBs, they're buying REITs, they're buying everything bar the kitchen sink. They are now trying to tacitly inflate that system. Well, if the whole system is trying to do the same thing, I have to say that whilst you have debt deflation on one side of the coin, on the other, you will have growth monetary inflation. So all those sectors that have a finite supply, whether it be oil at the margin, whether it be gold at the margin, and I say at the margin because demographics are rising globally. You know, as you wrote in your book, we went to 3 billion by 1961, and from 1961 to 2012, we've gone to 6 billion. That's an exponential rate. So there is a strain on resources, and it's not that we're running out of resources. Perhaps in the next millennia, that's not the point. It's the cost, in my mind, of extracting it and making that timely. So in an era of just-in-time inventory, this is going to put pressure on the price of goods and force them to go up, especially when you're increasing more of the numeraire against a dwindling or not so readily available supply. And that's when you get hyperinflation. So people who are calling for debt deflation or hyperinflation, I think both can happen simultaneously.
Well, it did happen, as you mentioned, in Zimbabwe, where, you know, I've heard people say inflation's really in check because look at capacity utilization. You know, until capacity utilization of the factories really ramps up, we're not going to experience inflation. But in Zimbabwe, I believe their cap ute was down to 10%, even as inflation was in the millions of percent. So that you clearly can have a disconnect between those. And this means that, you know, in my mind, that to widen that out, very interesting time in history right here. Anything that we might have formed as opinions or ideas or beliefs around how the world works over the last 20 years, we might have to crack that open or even chuck it out the window, because here's what we're facing now is, widen it all the way up, we have to ask the question, well, really, what is wealth? Ultimately, money is a marker for wealth. It is not wealth itself. And what is it making markers for? Well, it's the stuff we need, the stuff we want. And as you noted, global supplies of critical resources are strained at this moment in time, with China now consuming half of the world's coal, I believe, last year, and shooting upwards from there, with other critical resources. Maybe we can find ways to adjust and to produce more of these resources for a period of time, maybe decades even, but not in all cases and not in all circumstances, with, for me, the standout in this story being oil. Very mysteriously, we've not managed to increase production of regular, what I'll call conventional crude oil, since 2005, despite some very nice, hefty market pressures and pricing that would really encourage, you would think, quite a bit of production. And it's not just oil itself. We have to look at the different grades. It's light sweet is what the world wants. We seem to be in short supply of that. Plenty of sour crude kicking around. And this is where, you know, this is what the data is suggesting to us at this point. And so from my perspective, I see a world where real wealth represented in real resources, with the absolute cornerstone of that story being oil, particularly the grades of oil we want, sitting right there in plain sight, and all the central banks just blissfully unaware of that, apparently, and cranking the printing presses, because their model says if we can just create enough liquidity, the economy will grow again. It seems like a colossal set of forces that are lining up on two sides of the field here. I'm going with reality and oil as the potential winner of this match. How do you see it?
Well, you know, I think you bring up some pretty pertinent points. I think we're on the same page here. I do think that people will say that obviously productivity will improve, and as a consequence, some of these energy sources will be made more readily available more quickly, and I think that's the pertinent point. But you're up against a very challenging demographic. Obviously, in the developed world, we have collapsing demographics in terms of aging demographics in parts of Europe. But you've got this monstrous growth happening in the Asian economies particularly. And as we've already highlighted in just talking now, we've just talked about the exponential growth, worldwide growth. Clearly, that rate comes into conflict with the rate of productivity, and for me, you know, that's really the big issue. Now, I think we're hitting a perfect storm, unfortunately, where you're having inordinate amounts of money created electronically around the world in order to maintain a monetary regime that clearly is beginning to fail. I'm under no illusion that this is the start of this particular regime failure. I've seen in history that it's amazing how governments can often band together ultimately to keep the illusion. But I think as people are now really beginning to assess about the validity of credit and what, as you've talked about, what is wealth, you know, what is the value of my daily labor? Well, guess what? You know, it's really under threat when I see that it's being debased every day. It's like, how do I impute what a value of oil is? How do I impute an ear of corn? What is the value of that when you're constantly changing the yardstick or that currency or that numeraire? That becomes a very difficult difficult aspect to ascertain. And so clearly we've got this very interesting dynamic where you've got positive demographics and you have just an inordinate amount of money being primed into the system, and they are at odds with each other. Now, the feedback mechanism there, clearly for oil, it actually works as a tax on us in terms of traditional economics. As the oil price rises, because we're still so heavily dependent on it worldwide, that actually has an impact on our disposable income. Now, even if we start talking about replacement energy, natural gas obviously is clearly shale gas, etc. These are alternatives. And I can see that there's a major disconnect between what the price of European gas is and US gas, natural gas. And I'm sure that as they find more sophisticated or clever ways to transport liquefied gas around the globe, you know, that price will move up. So again, all the time, I just see that there's a constant strain. Now, I know you're very, you're rightly fascinated with energy dynamics, and I think they're hugely pertinent even in our lifetime. But for me right now, as a fund manager, I'm just concerned with trying to preserve wealth for my clients and for myself and for my family. And markets are so distorted today that I really throw my hands up in despair. I can't with any conscience put people into bond markets because they're effectively owned wholeheartedly now by the financial system, which is now run by the government. US government buys US bonds, the UK government buys government bonds, they buy MBS. So what we're seeing here in reality is interest rate premiums are being squeezed lower. So interest rates are being set at a face value that's really not reflective of the true marketplace. Interest rates are based on human preference of where people want to lend or borrow. And the reality is when they're so artificially low, it distorts the whole term structure of the financial system. So to just extrapolate that on, extend that thought process, look at equity markets at the moment. It's just incredulous. They seem to be rallying. I call it the reluctant rally because most people aren't invested at this point, because there is just a huge disconnect between the credibility of what's actually happening in the real economy, which is effectively events in Greece, and people are losing their jobs. Aggregate demand is falling, and globally there's issues in China. It's not just even that economy is really starting to starting to slow down, grind to a halt in its terms, moving from 10% GDP down to 7% GDP is a material shift. So things are slowing down considerably around the world. So I think that you have this dynamic where for equity markets they're rallying because the discount rate, which is being set by bond rates, which is being set by government, is artificially low. And so that discount mechanism is driving equities higher, i.e. that debasement of the currency is underpinning these equity markets. Now, at times, you get this risk on, risk off. And the reason why we're seeing such high correlation between asset classes is that very reason, that the term structure is being shriveled to a very low yield, which affects all markets converge to a return or a yield or a productive asset. And really, when you go to the zero bound, every asset class ultimately moves towards that. So equities are rallying to such a point in which there will be a zero yield return for you. Likewise, bond assets have gone to a negative yield. there's absolutely, it's just, for me, there is absolutely, I know I'm going to lose not only capital, but after inflation, I'm losing 3-4%, almost whichever bond market in the developed world that I want to invest in. This is the insidious part of the financial system for me right now, which is, what do I turn to? How do I grow my business for my investors? Well, unfortunately, I just keep coming back to gold, which it protects me in an inflationary environment, and it protects me in a deflation environment, probably more so because it has zero risk of default. And that's a really important point for me.
Absolutely. But, and so in gold, I assume we're talking not ETFs, but physical gold or something where I guess where I'm going with this is MF Global, that debacle really sort of changed my perspective on the safety of assets and whatnot. So bird in the hands, worth two in the bush, I guess. How do you invest in gold in this particular landscape?
Well, no, you bring up a very interesting point, MF Global. I just want to address that before we talk about ways of investing in gold. But something that we haven't talked about, but is at the root cause of the problem with our financial system today, fractional reserve banking and the excessive credit lending beyond just central bank money creation, is the concept of rehypothecation. And clearly what's happened with, I should probably define what rehypothecation is, or I should say what hypothecation is. Hypothecation is where a borrower pledges collateral to secure some debt. So, i.e., the borrower retains ownership of that collateral. But obviously, hypothetically, this is controlled by the creditor. A good example would be, I guess, consumers enter into a mortgage agreement, for example, in which the consumer's house becomes the collateral and until the mortgage loan is paid off. So that's hypothecation. Rehypothecation is a practice that occurs in financial markets, and I think to some extent first came to everyone's attention in, with the Lehman debacle and the repo 101s. This is where the banks or a broker-dealer can reuse that collateral that's been pledged by a client, or and they can reuse that collateral as collateral for more borrowings. So this is what's happened in the case of MF Global. And interestingly, talking about, you know, we just talked about income and yield. What were they trying to do? Causeen was an ex Goldman Sachs individual. He was trying to create an income statement, just like Goldman Sachs does, which is short-term, borrow in the short-term, lend long-term, you get the yield curve pickup. Now, that yield curve has been narrowed. So he had an opportunity to purchase high-yielding peripheral debt on the belief that he could, you know, that the ECB or governments would step in and save the day, as we have to some extent. You know, they bought them at significant discounts, they get a yield, so that the likelihood of a default is already priced in to some extent, so they've got some cushion there. But they're all the time they're earning that yield and that pull to par, except they were using collateral that had already been pledged by clients and then pledging that as collateral to borrow more. And so you can see the insidious circle here. And MF Global is a microcosm, but it just exemplifies everything that's wrong with a credit-based system, the whole rehypothecation process. But what scares me most is how much collateral has been pledged and where it's been pledged. It's almost impossible for us to ascertain that. Very, very, very difficult. And that brings you on to the whole layer of what you call, I think you called it part of your tertiary wealth. Well, I wouldn't call this wealth, but all the credit derivatives are out there. Everyone talks about netting, and it's okay, it all nets off. And sure, you have banks that have now, if they've got shorter swap and longer swap, they've made sure that it's with the same counterparty to try and reduce some of that risk, and they don't have to put up as much collateral. Well, to me, it's the gross risk is really the most frightening element of it. That exponential growth in derivatives, which, by the way, has just ballooned since 2007 because it's really been the only way to try and keep the deleveraging taking place, and the consequence of which would be a collapse in aggregate demand, as clearly as there'd just be default process right across the board, corporates at the retail level, et cetera, et cetera. So you've had this constant build-up of the credit market, and we've now probably got over $1 trillion worth of derivatives, and I'm sure it gets... That, for me, is a great example of a complex system. And from what I can see in nature, complex systems, you sow the seeds of their demise within the build-up of that structure. You know, for example, there's a great book by a chap called Sornet, a physicist, and he talked about stock markets crashing and how we could predict them. Now, he actually predicated some of his predictions based on behaviors that happen in nature. For example, Ariadne 4 and 5 are rocket ships that they had these, they kept rupturing, and it was actually the Kevlar bonding matrix that they used. Actually, the way it bonded together, it almost bonded to an imitative behavior, like we get imitative behavior in markets. And that ruptured, and it just very minor fissures, and then under severe stress, they would blow up. And that's really very analogous to what we're seeing today, except you can see the imitative behavior that we're all, you know, following the same, we're all herding in the same way in terms of how we're being forced to borrow at lower and lower rates because that's the only way we can service our own mortgages, et cetera, et cetera. So we're constantly reinforcing to the system until such time as, let's say, the main buyer has to stop, i.e. government, and then what happens? Who's the buyer in the bond markets then? What happens when people go to sell? There's no buyer. The system collapses. Rates will go through the roof. People will not be able to service their mortgages. Does that articulate the sort of the cataclysmic element of markets today?
It's a couple of very important concepts in here. One, that our system obviously is a complex system. The economy, the financial system is a complex system, which is interesting to hear that there's a, Sornet believes that you can predict these things. Because something we do know about complex systems is they're, it's not that they're fully unpredictable. So waves crashing on the shore, we know that these are a complex system, but you can be pretty reasonably certain if there are 3-foot waves coming in, you won't see a 12-footer in the mix. But you know, within that boundary, it's impossible to predict how each wave will individually break. So we have a complex system. I think that it's, you know, to even a very, very close observer such as yourself or anybody who's in the system, you just peer into it and you go, cool, this, nobody really understands how the whole derivative market is fully put together. And certainly if that escapes the architects of it, it's got to escape, say, I don't know, your average ECB bureaucrat who's trying to manage within that system. So I believe that there's a general feeling of angst that we've got this large, growing, exponentially growing, complex system. Nobody quite has their arms around it. We don't exactly know what's going to happen, you know, when it might break or what the trigger would be, but we have a sense that it can't keep just growing forever. And you've articulated, though, there are these risks, there are these strains, there are these pressures that are being placed upon it, that the derivative market is now larger than when the crisis started, that I think we're looking at overall debt levels are actually now in aggregate larger than when this crisis started. The complexity, if anything, seems to be greater, not lesser, than when we started. So these are all just sort of risks. And in the context of that, how do you do your job? How do you preserve or even grow capital during this tumultuous period? And in, you know, specifically, how do you invest in gold, given what we just talked about with the hypothecation and rehypothecation scandals?
Well, I'm going to answer that second and remind me to answer that second, but I want to address that we actually wrote a piece called Silver Criticality, and we were able to ascertain, actually using Sonnet's work and some of our own work on fractals, actually, you know, quite basic concepts of, you have something called self-similarity. An example would be when you magnify on a snowflake at every level, they look the same. We call this scale invariance. Now, or self-similar. Now, it was very clear that you could see imitative herding-like behavior occurring within the silver market. And the point about just before a crash is that it's actually the preceding months, years leading up to a critical change in the state of the market, for instance, is endogenous. You can see it building and you can mathematically predict it. Now, that's an example of a complex system where we could predict it. I think the difference today is that not one person on the planet, in my opinion, can really ascertain every asset or derivative out there so that they can make a mathematical probability of when it will happen. And that's the difference. So I could say that overnight we could have a trigger that would catch us, and we would think it had come out of nowhere, but clearly in hindsight we'll be able to say, well, we saw the endogenous effects of build-up of credit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was clearly going to happen. An example would be something that's just happened recently is the downgrade of all the banks. Now, it wasn't news to market participants. In many ways, it was already priced in the market. The market's reasonably efficient. But actually, you have unintended consequences often arise within complex systems. An example in this case would be you have provisions within derivative contracts from one counterparty to another, not bank to bank I'm talking about here, but let's say bank to a pension fund, where the pension fund now can come back and say, hang on, you've been downgraded, I need more collateral, or I'm going to reassign or just tear up this swap agreement. So it's an immediate loss for that bank. Now, that's the kind of behavior that I've started to hear about recently, only in recent weeks. And before you know it, that snowball effect is it. And that a good example would be it's that drop of sand on the larger slope of sand that suddenly, inconsequentially but very catastrophically, sends the slide down the mountain. You know, you're that avalanche. Mm-hmm. And you don't understand why it's that particular grain. So there's this whole build-up. So to me, the system's very febrile, and at any point it can collapse. So this comes back to what do we have to do as human beings in terms of protecting wealth. And you did a great job in your book, and this is the book I wish I had written. I think it's a beautifully written book, and you've managed to not only assimilate and disseminate a lot of information in a very concise manner, but I think you've addressed very eloquently some key aspects, which is, you know, how do you define wealth? And I'm not going to label them off, but primary, secondary, and tertiary wealth. But I'd also, wealth for me is not just how I value my day's labor. Wealth is always connected with my relationships. I believe fundamentally, outside of being a fund manager, that I need to have the ability to be self-sufficient. I need sustainability. In many ways, I need to make sure that I achieve the first stage of Maslow's hierarchy, so I have food, shelter, fire, etc., etc. And then I go up the levels. You know, maybe the second one is safety, second stage. Now, part of safety for me, and this is where I see gold, physical allocated gold is by definition outside the construct of the financial system. You know, it comes from primary wealth. It's dug out of the ground. So it's a resource that cannot easily be created. And that's a very key thing in regard to why it's a great protection against inflation. You can't produce inordinate amounts of it. And arguably, there is a finite amount. But as importantly, and probably more importantly for me, is that it has no default risk, particularly in a credit environment where, you know, clearly there's some debt deleveraging going on. You know, I can lose my capital. I cannot lose my gold. And I won't lose my gold if I hold it within an allocated form, which means it's in the name of the holder. Now, as a fund manager who hopefully believes that somehow we will get through this unholy mess and that the system will survive, I am going to continue to ply my trade because that's how I earn my living. And I want to protect my clients and myself, my family's purchasing power. Now, I want to be positive, despite looking at the math and despite the fact that I think the system, there's going to be a huge monetary regime, it is completely possible this can spin out over decades. it's amazing how government can obfuscate the situation. And you know, perhaps we can come back to talking about financial repression and how I think they can do that. It's completely possible we can spin this out much longer. I don't. That's not my base case. But in the interim, you know, I want to be positive. So I want to do what I think is right by investors, which is, for me, running a gold fund. And we store our gold in allocated form, and we try and create a return in excess of the gold price. And we don't need to go into how or why we do that, but we've managed to create a return of, I think it's 15% annualized above the gold price, which we're very proud of. And, you know, I definitely feel that I've doing a more worthwhile job than sitting there as a bond trader as I was once, perhaps a decade ago.
Well, fantastic. I'd be interested to hear more about that. And of course, I think people could go to your website at Hind Capital and explore that more if they're interested. And I'm interested. And you also focus on commodities in general. And I was intrigued noting here that in some of the earnings reports I was just sort of checking out, Kraft, for instance. So Kraft sells a lot of food items. Their sales rose because prices went up 7.6% and volume actually fell 1.5%. Go figure. You know, rising prices ended up having a softening on volume impact. And they had the price increases in all kinds of categories. By lunch meats, they actually ended up offering smaller sizes to address the sticker shock people were feeling. And in others like bacon, they nearly doubled the price because the cost spikes. But then, of course, you know, sales struggled. I mean, this is serious. We're talking about bacon now. And I'm looking at all of this, and I'm seeing inflation coming through very clearly in a lot of the reports I'm reading. It's not coming through in the official statistics, of course. And you mentioned that gold will do well in an inflationary regime and even probably better in a deflationary regime because of how it will protect against that default risk, meaning it's an asset you can count on, which is a pretty dear asset indeed when the system itself is struggling. So as you look across the landscape, do you see our commodities and gold, are these a way to just sidestep what's going on as we wait for happier times, or these have another story in there as well, which is related to, I guess, what we were talking about before with 7 billion people on the planet and potentially limited and limiting supplies of critical items? How are you approaching commodities right now?
Okay, well, yeah, it's very interesting. One, I agree with you that clearly reported statistics bear no relation to the reality. I would say in the UK that my personal run rate, and I consider myself pretty average middle income individual, contrary to what people might think about hedge fund managers earning vast fortunes. You know, we ply an honest trade. I have a above average income perhaps, but nonetheless I have very similar outgoings to most people in this country, and I would say my inflation rate is nearer 10%. Absolutely, and obviously the old games of reducing packaging have been going on for years, and keeping the price the same, and you know, it's just scandalous. And I think people have cottoned onto it to some extent, but there's not a lot they can do about it. I actually feel very strongly that my wealth really should be assigned with gold, because I believe that to be my true operational wealth. I personally do not hold commodities. We just wrote a report, actually, it's on our website, called The Myth of Commodity Diversification. And I think that in classic portfolio management, that over the last, particularly within a fiat currency system, that actually commodities are not a very good way to diversify your portfolio. You know, this is if we're strictly talking about portfolio management. I have to be clear here. So I feel that I have to have a large holding relative to, if I have equities and bonds in my portfolio, which actually I do not. I have a large proportion of my wealth, I would say 85%, in physical gold, because I believe that is true money. And I believe that despite people like Buffett, who obviously incredibly erudite and smart individual, unlike Buffett, just because gold has no seeming yield, I actually think it keeps up with the rate of money supply. In fact, it's actually undervalued relative to the monetary base. It's only backs at 15%. To give you a clue, in 1981, that backing was 140%, which is when we knew gold was overvalued. So today, gold looks extremely undervalued relative to the monetary base and effectively the leverage that has been created in the system. So it seems like a very cheap way if you just want to participate just from a capital appreciation perspective. But for me, I don't look at it that. I just look at it as a means of protecting my operational wealth. I also can use it much more readily. I can't, if I go and buy a basket of commodities at a firm, to be honest, I've got counterparty risk that right now I don't want to be putting myself at risk, because I believe that we've got a we're in ensuing debt deflation. We haven't even begun to see the deleveraging yet, so I don't want to take on that added risk. At least I feel that I have a physical ownership, and I'm with my partner, one of the largest shareholders in our fund, so I'm heavily aligned. So, and I feel that the structure that we have is very sound, because we have physical gold held in a Swiss vault in a private bank called Banque Julius Baer, so it's outside the investment banking system, and that's very important to me. And some people say to me, well, don't you need to own it in your house or in safety deposit boxes? And I don't feel that, because at its core, at my core, I believe the system will ultimately continue to exist, although in a bastardized form, and hopefully it will have a new beginning whenever that will be. But I think you'll be amazed at how society continues even under the extreme duress. You just have to look at Latin America. I just talked to a lot of the businessmen there and how they cope with hyperinflation. They continue to run some of their business. They just manage their billing system and their receipts, and they made it work for them. So it's amazing how ingenious that we can become. So I think the system, I don't think that banks are going to be falling whole scale, partly because actually transactional banking will continue. It's just what you're transacting won't be worth anything.
Well, fantastic. This is all the time we have for today. I want to give people an opportunity, though, to find some very nice writings you have on your website. How do they get there, and are there any pieces you would direct them to?
Well, if you want to understand gold, I would read a piece called Gold, the Currency of First Resort. If you want to understand the relationship of the state and how they're trying to conscript capital, and the solution that we propose for the monetary system, I would look at something called monetary singularity. Actually, I think it's called Singularity Transcendent Money on the website. It sounds a bit pretentious, and it's not meant to be, and I gave a speech on this, and I was thankful that afterwards everyone said, I thought that was going to be really pretentious, but it wasn't. It was spot on, and I felt very relieved about that, because I think it's very easy for us to overcomplicate and be over verbose, as often I can be, but this is actually very simple subject matter. But you can find that at our website, and it's called www.hindcapital.com, and Hind is H-I-N-D-E capital.com. Thank you for that plug. I appreciate that.
And thank you so much for kind words about my book. Obviously, this conversation could go on a lot longer, and I hope to do that at some point. Particularly, there's a number of subsectors that we opened up that we didn't really get to address. There's so much to discuss here. The system itself needs to be understood, and then within that, how do we operate and maneuver given what we know. And by the way, what we know changes, for me at least, almost every week now, as rules get changed, as new things are revealed, as data becomes into sharper focus, and as we learn more, and as various players are maneuvering around. It's a very interesting time. And I think, for me, the lesson is I'm both hunkered down and extremely alert. I'm like you. I'm hunkered down in my, my gold holdings are about 75% of my core holdings right now. And at the same time, I'm just remaining as alert as possible to all the things that are just changing daily, it seems, at this point.
I would echo those words. I think being alert is key. I mean, one thing I would say as we round off, is that really, unfortunately, a credit-based system or a fiat currency system where the welfare looks after so much of your needs, what tends to happen is that we've effectively had responsibility for ourselves expropriated from us. So I would say the most important thing for myself and my family, and hopefully people will echo this who are beginning to understand what's happening, is that you have to take responsibility for yourself. And that involves providing sustainable resources for yourself. And when I say sustainable resources or wealth, I mean by that, that can be social wealth, that can be gold holdings that protects your day's labor, and obviously being self-sufficient, that because we have just-in-time inventories, and that really is an issue, we need to be able to fend fully for ourselves in terms of food and shelter. And that isn't to be doom and gloom at all. I just think that's very sensible insurance.
Absolutely prudent adult-sized sort of responses to what's a very uncertain time. And the cost of doing these things is not high. The social cost might be for some people. It feels weird and awkward, but the physical and financial cost is not typically all that large. It's like an incredibly cheap insurance policy. You know, you pay a dollar or a pound to get a $10,000 of coverage. It just seems very reasonable. So that's all the time we have for today. Ben, thank you so much for your time. And it's been just fascinating. I look forward to doing it again.
So look, thanks very much for having me on. Cheers.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.